A big midweek Wednesday show for November 20th. Christine Stewart checked in from ctnewsjunkie.com to talk about tolls and the aftermath, the dust settling, maybe, regarding the Democrats now backing away from car tolls. Totally, they say. Chris Powell, columnist for the Manchester Journal-Inquirer, stopped by, not afraid, of course, to ride or talk about the tough issues, including immigration in the state. And we got a preview of the next Democratic debate from Dr. Gary Rose, chair of the Political Science Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And that's us. Hey, thanks. How are you? Hour number two here. Thank you, Mr. Big Voice. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Well, the last couple of days have certainly been interesting up at the Capitol. Now we've got somewhat of a retreat, somewhat on tolls, but now we're back to tolling trucks as we go round and round and round on the toll merry-go-round. Hop on, kids. It's fun. Christine Stewart joins us from ctnewsjunkie.com. Are you getting tired of writing about this?
Never. It's taken a few turns today, so,
yeah.
But no meetings have been scheduled, and so nobody has sat down and decided to have a conversation about this.
Okay, so what's the buzz today, Christine, after what was announced yesterday? Matt Ritter held his news little get-together. I'm sure you were there. Well, what's the buzz now you're hearing?
Well, I mean, it's like Oprah, you know, you have a plan and you have a plan and you have a plan. And now we have to get together and make it work. The buzz here today is that, the House Democratic plan would eliminate tolling on passenger vehicles. And that was proposed yesterday. But Lamont said that he is just interested at resolving this problem and everybody sees it as a problem. So let's get to work on this, so he said that the problem is getting these people to make a tough vote and to get the state moving again.
I noticed something, Christine, yesterday. I know whether you picked up on it. There was Matt Ritter, saying, listen, forget this. What is it? The camel in the tent thing.
The camel's nose under the tent. Yeah.
And under questioning by Mark Davis, I found it interesting. Did you pick up where Matt Ritter said, well, I would never vote for anything that would leave another agency like a DOT or the DMV or an independent body with the power to say, okay, now we flip the switch on cars. I found that interesting that Mark brought that up and said, well, wait a minute. Are you guaranteeing this won't be left to the DOT? Which I found, again, interesting.
Well, I mean, the governor's plan basically says we're going to contract with a vendor who's going to put up the toll gantries and collect the toll money for us. And that contract is only going to be for 10 years. And so as soon as that contract is over, we're taking down the tolls. And so as part of that guarantee and that the legislature would be unable to interfere in that and unable to interfere in any sort of the prices. It wouldn't be congestion pricing. So mm-hmm. We're not going to see anything like they see in Virginia where it's like $40 one way to get to work.
Yeah. Christine, I take calls here and it's sad. And, it's a pox on both the parties there. But a lot of the callers here that I talk to, they say, that's fine. We don't trust you. And that's a major problem.
Right. And there's nothing in any of these plans to be able to get over the trust issue. It's just not possible to get over that trust hurdle. I mean, that has been built up over years and years and years of politicians, some of whom are not even in office right now. So there is a lack of trust. So some of the new car sales tax was swept before it got to the special transportation fund in this budget that they just passed. There's a reason why the public doesn't trust lawmakers.
And you wonder why, and you wonder how, rather, I'm sorry. You wonder, how do they, I was picking my brain about this on the air yesterday, Christine. How does that trust get built back up? I mean, it's almost like the folks you cover up there need a few years, right, of being trustworthy, of saying, okay, we learned our lesson. We won't stick our hand to the candy jar anymore. It's like when you're a kid. Okay, show me you're going to behave for 2 years, and then I'll let you have the keys to the car. But, you know, it's a scenario now where a lot of voters say, we might not even do that. In a roundabout way, Christine, I kind of feel sorry for a lot of the well-meaning legislators up there.
Yeah, and I think that they are well-meaning, and I think that they genuinely want to get some bipartisan support for a proposal. I think they all agree that we have a problem, and in order to get our state moving forward economically, we need to fix our transportation problems. We have an out-migration issue. People are leaving the state of Connecticut. So I think that it's good that they do have agreement on what the goal is. It's just, how do you finance that?
How do you, Christine, final question, how do you, and you've watched this as close as anyone else, the impact of Patrick Sasser's groups, the NoTollCT.org people, who I've talked to numerous times. There was a piece the other day, and, you know, there was a piece, you probably saw it, where Max Reese was saying, whatever, they're just a bunch of loud people. And then there are people on the other side saying, well, wait a minute, if it wasn't for them with 100,000 signatures and the social media presence, this might not have hit the bump it did. What are your own thoughts on that as to the opposition they put up? How important do you think that was?
And how influential they've been in what's been happening here?
Yeah.
I think that they've definitely played a role. And let's not, you know, they are a grassroots organization, but at the same time, they've also registered as a lobbyist. So they are a registered lobbyist. And so they have, you know, and they're able to raise money. So it's obviously not as much money as the unions have or, some of the supporters of the toll plan have, but it has had an influence.
Yeah. Christine, thank you. We appreciate it. And continue the good work up there, ctnewsjunkie.com. I refer to it every day. And enjoy the fun, because I know no 2 days are alike up there. Thanks, Christine. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. There you go. Well, Christine Stewart gets to watch that stuff every day at the Capitol, 5 days a week. And that's good. You know, listen, as good of a job as the mainstream papers do in this state, the Hartford Courant, the Connecticut Post, the Hearst Media Papers, the New Haven Register, Waterbury, the Manchester J.I., all these papers do a good job, but it's these micro news sites like the News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com, the Connecticut Mirror, and the aggregator sites like the Capitol Report. That really has become a needed part, an important part of the way the journalism is handled and covered in this state. So again, if you've never visited her site, ctnewsjunkie.com, really gets to kind of like, you know, there's a football term, you get to the second level, you get behind the line of scrimmage, you get to the second level where the linebackers are and a defense. That's kind of like what these micro sites do, the News Junkie site, the Connecticut Mirror, other sites out there. Capitol Report is an aggregator. So there is, you know, there's no shortage of ways, shall we say, to know what's going on here in the state. So we'll see what happens, see if both sides can come together and, you know, perhaps come up with a plan here. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Once again, our question at facebook.com at WICC600, are you okay with just trucks being tolled? Remember, we've come full circle now. And I do know a lot of people before this whole thing blew up who said, you know what, toll the trucks. They're big, they're heavy, they probably cause a lot of the potholes and a lot of the stress and repeated impacts on, you know, expansion joints, on bridges and highways, which are very, very difficult and expensive to fix. It's a lengthy process. If you've ever seen that on a bridge, it can take several days with numerous crews doing it right. So a lot of people I've talked to said, you know what, if it's trucks, okay, whatever. And they don't even care, actually, if that cost of those tolls is just passed on to people. It's a cost of doing business. Because, again, you have to maintain things, people. Already, we mentioned yesterday, we're already seeing, what, cracks in the Pearl Harbor Bridge in New Haven? How about that?
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And we do thank you for that. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC on the radio and, of course, online 24/7 on the internet at WICC600.com. Welcoming back here a gentleman who always makes us think, and I've been reading with interest his last few columns, including one that came out after we had a scenario here a couple of weeks ago where we had an illegal immigrant that essentially holed himself up at the Derby courthouse to hide from ICE agents who were there ostensibly to perhaps take him into custody. We don't really know, but Chris Powell joins us from the Manchester Journal-Inquirer. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Hey, Paul, good to be with you.
And thank you so much for taking the time again. We appreciate it. You know, we were kind of doing a play-by-play on this a couple of weeks ago, watching all the social media, all the reports here, when this this gentleman, Mr. Scherer, essentially hid in a courthouse, in the office of the public defender there. Everybody eventually went home. As far as we know, he wasn't taken into custody any further. He's got another court day coming up. But you wrote a rather interesting piece, I thought, kind of asking, you know, why is this sort of stuff, I guess, Chris, normalized, or why do people just kind of yawn at this stuff when at least you think that we have to ask ourselves deeper questions about this whole thing?
Yeah, I thought the case, Paul, showed that, Connecticut's official policy really is not just open borders, but that there should be no immigration law whatsoever. The guy was arrested in connection with a domestic disturbance with his wife, and when he went to the courthouse in Derby to address the charges, the ICE agents were following him. He hid in the public defender's office. The public defender's office let him in to hide. This is a courthouse where supposedly the law is being followed, but the public defender's office was obstructing the immigration law enforcement. He hid there for the rest of the day till the courthouse closed. The agents went home, and then some people from a immigration law obstruction group, Unidad Latina en Acción, descended around him to protect him and spirited him away to a safe location in New Haven, where you've got tens of thousands of illegal immigrants holding city identification cards to facilitate their law-breaking. The New Haven Independent and New Haven Register really celebrated this guy's escape. The Independent even published a photo of him in his safe location with the immigration law obstruction people. He was standing next to a lady who was holding the sign that said, erase all borders, and he himself was holding a sign that in Spanish read blank the immigration agents. And our senior U.S. Senator, Dick Blumenthal, put out a statement supporting the guy. And
it's a guy, Chris, who had, like you say, he was a suspect, at least, in a domestic violence incident, and he freely admits that he overstayed his visa, not for a week, not for a month, not for a year, for 3 years.
Yeah, he's been in the country illegally for 3 years. He's been working illegally at a restaurant in Bridgeport. Now, I'm not suggesting he's the most dangerous criminal in the United States, but he's violating the immigration law. He's been in the country illegally for 3 years, and here he is holding a sign that says blank the immigration agents. He's standing next to a sign that says erase all borders. Is this really what our U.S. Senator Blumenthal wants to be facilitating? What's this guy's right to be exempt from immigration law enforcement? But that's really our policy in Connecticut. Our policy in Connecticut is that anybody who breaks into the country illegally or manages to overstay a visa and gets to Connecticut should be exempt from immigration law enforcement. I mean, this is nullification of federal law, just like the old Confederate states were trying to nullify enforcement of civil rights laws, back in the 60s and 70s.
No, thank you, Chris, because that's what it is when you have. And, Chris, it's not even like, and I mention this all the time, It's not like back in the day, Chris, you and I can remember, where we had one Senate member who was a Republican and one who was a Democrat, and three members of the House who were Republicans and three members who were Democrats, and occasionally a Republican or conservative constitutional officer, you know, used to slip in under the governor's seat when they weren't watching. You know, now you can't. We're so blue here. We're just not blue here in this state, Chris. And yes, it's what the voters decide, but at least I would say half of the people in the state, maybe a little less, look at the situation and say, so my opinion on this apparently doesn't count.
Well, I'm afraid that, you know, too many of our elected officials and politicians are just intimidated out of addressing this this issue. If you're ready to argue that we should have some immigration law, you've also got to be prepared to be called a racist or you're a white supremacist. I mean, one of the illegal immigration groups the other day put out another press release, which was essentially saying that if you support any immigration law enforcement, you're a white supremacist. Well, you know, is it not possible to favor a liberal immigration policy and still think that we should not have open borders, that we should know what we're getting when we admit people into the United States? I mean, do we really want no judgment made on whether we're admitting people who think the government should be a religious theocracy? Do we not want to make sure we're not admitting people who want homosexuals thrown off five-story buildings? I mean, there's all sorts of crazy people in the world and all sorts of crazy ideologies. And if we want to maintain a secular democracy in the United States, we've got to be careful about immigration. That doesn't mean that we have got to judge immigrants by their race or ethnicity or anything like that. It's just we got to have some rules. We got to be a little bit careful here. And open borders is the destruction of the United States, and that's what these people are advocating.
And Chris, there are also people who obviously either don't want to or haven't studied history, and even on shows like this and people in my own circle of friends, I have to say, listen, you might not agree with people like Stephen Miller in the Trump White House now, but you do know that in the past history, the U.S. numerous times has adjusted our immigration levels for whatever reason, for wartime preparedness, for the economy or whatever. And I mention things like that, and you probably do too among the folks that you may know. And, you know, you get the open mouth thing like, no, we've always used immigration as a spigot. Sometimes a spigot is wide open, and other times you notch it back a lot.
Well, there's a lot of judgment to be applied to the immigration issue. The problem with admitting a lot of unskilled and low-skilled people is that you further disadvantage the unskilled and low-skilled people in the United States that we've already got. We don't do terribly good by, but that's really not the issue here. If you don't have some control of your borders, eventually you don't have a country. I mean, I think, you know, all the sympathy that's expressed lately for, you know, the so-called indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. Well, you know, they did not have border control, and that's, you know, why they're not exercising their ethnic sovereignty anymore. I'm not looking to exercise ethnic sovereignty. I'm looking to maintain the sovereignty of a democratic secular nation, and I will not make any apologies for that.
A renewed debate, or amidst rather a new debate about, you know, the value and cost benefit of a 4-year college. And once again, to spend a few more minutes with us, columnist Chris Powell from the Manchester JI. Chris, your contention in your latest column I read, which is excellent, says that if people are disappointed with the college numbers, they need to look a little further back a few years.
Yeah, I think the problem really is our social promotion policy in primary schools, Paul. The Education Reform Now group came out with this study a few days ago, noting that a bunch of our colleges in Connecticut are failing to graduate even half of their students in 6 years, and Some of them are particularly bad in graduating minority students. They're dropping out without a degree in 6 years or less. The executive director of the Education Reform Now group said too many Connecticut students are simply not set up for success. And that is really an old complaint, but nobody ever does anything about it. The kids in Connecticut's high schools now, more than half are being graduated from high schools without ever mastering high school math and English. And if they get into a public college or university, most of them end up taking remedial high school courses. So I don't think it's any great surprise that they should not graduate within 6 years. They're not prepared for college, but we funnel them out to college even though they've never mastered high school work. And this is, I think, a consequence of our social promotion policy. Our education establishment has decided that self-esteem is really going to be the highest value in education. And all the kids now, they know that you don't have to learn a damn thing to be advanced from grade to grade, and you don't have to learn a damn thing to graduate from high school. A few years ago, the judge that was handling the latest school financing lawsuit, Thomas Mukauscher, wrote a decision that emphasized that many Connecticut high schools are graduating illiterates. Well, and then we send them on to public colleges, often on scholarship, and they don't succeed because they're not prepared. The college failure is really a reflection of the failure of our primary schools, and our primary schools fail because we have no standards in lower education anymore.
And Chris, I wonder if you did an anonymous or some sort of a shielded poll of teachers and asked them about the social promotion. At least the teachers I know, Chris, the ones that really take it seriously, I would guess that they wouldn't like it. But as you and I, both know that a lot of times what a teacher often wants or what they think is best for the students is not necessarily reflected by a city or town's administration, a board of ed, or a teachers union person.
No, I don't really blame the teachers here, Paul. So many of them, they have a problem with a student. They can't get a parent on the phone, and most of the kids, they're not most, maybe many anyway, or who are troublesome, are living in homes without parents. Really, about I think 40% of the kids in the state are living in homes without a father, and mm-hmm. I think it's close to 90% of the kids in the cities. Many of the kids in the cities are being raised not by parents at all, but by grandparents. I mean, this is a terribly handicapping environment, and it's not the fault of the teachers.
So then, Chris, you write about this, you and I discuss it, but again, it seems that every two or three or four years, this kind of pops up with these studies, and everybody kind of looks at each other with a collective sigh, and I guess unless there's a big societal upheaval or even a ripple, Chris, I don't see a way out of this.
Well, politically, it's getting more and more difficult. I mean, what politician, what elected official can go back to his own constituents and tell 40 or 50% of them that they're doing a lousy job as parents and they got to do better as parents? They got to pay more attention to their kids, and they got to pay more attention to their kids' educations. I'm afraid that the childbearing outside marriage problem that we have in the state and throughout the country is now so big that confronting it is politically impossible.
Yeah, and Chris, in the times that I've tried to discuss this among friends and co-workers and even on shows like this, I inevitably get the sniping back, well, there's nothing wrong with a single mother. Plenty of single mothers do the job. He said, no, but that's not the criticism. The criticism is that a single mother, right, Chris, as well-intentioned as they are, can only do so much. Or a single father, a single parent is very tough.
Well, they used to say, two can live as cheaply as one. I think two can have a lot easier time in raising children than one. And, you know, whether any particular single parent does a good job or a bad job, the social science now is overwhelming. There's even the liberal social science will acknowledge that childbearing outside marriage correlates overwhelmingly with trouble with the law, with drug problems, with physical and mental and health problems, with educational failure. The outcomes for children raised in single parent households are much poorer than they are for children raised in two parent households. And I think this is the central problem of society in the United States right now. And I think we would, if we were going to pursue it, we would track it back to the welfare system and the perverse incentives it provides to people to abandon their children.
Chris, thank you, and keep writing about the uncomfortable stuff because you do it well. Chris, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Chris Powell there, Manchester J.I. You can read his columns. He was the former managing editor, now still doing a weekly column or two, and he writes about the uncomfortable stuff.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
Hey, hi there. It's the 5 o'clock hour, 5:07. How are you? We'll check traffic and weather together for you again on your ride home, wherever you're heading, in less than 10 minutes, right here on WICC 600, where we are for you 24/7, also online at WICC600.com. This is Connecticut Today. Paul Pacelli here behind the mic and Aaron Johnson behind the glass. Once again, we're at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Joining us again because, believe it or not, it's debate night. Not too many people talking about this one because impeachment is sucking up all the air in the room. Dr. Gary Rose, chair and professor in the Department of Government and Politics at Sacred Heart University. Gary, how are you? How you been? Everything good?
Everything good, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. Boy, this one kind of snuck up on us. You know, the first few debates we talked about, there was a big buildup here, but because of the impeachment thing going on, that's kind of taken up all the air in the room, as I mentioned. But this one could be interesting, Gary, because of, again, depending upon which poll you look at, all the different twists and turns that have happened here over the last couple of weeks or so.
Yeah, I think what's particularly interesting is how we now have a new front runner in Iowa, which, as everyone knows, is really a pivotal caucus state. Mayor Pete Buttigieg has, in the last couple of weeks, he's really moved into first place, which is, I think, really the big story as far as the Iowa caucus is concerned in this debate tonight. And so I think we're going to see in tonight's a debate, a conscious attempt on the part of people like Warren and Biden and Sanders and others to actually now start taking Mayor Pete down, because that's always what happens. Who's ever in the front becomes really the target. So I think that's really the emerging story in the Iowa caucus.
He's an interesting candidate because he comes over, Gary, is very measured. He's not a bomb thrower. His policy positions are decently thought out. For example, he said, well, I wouldn't do Medicare for all unless I tried it out first. He's talking about a voluntary program that then would be evaluated after a few years. And again, he doesn't throw bombs. He doesn't say stuff like Kamala Harris, well, I'm going to get rid of private insurance. Yes. And, you know, shut down the entire state of Connecticut. So the guy's no dummy here. He's not.
No, not at all. He's also a veteran, which, of course, checks an important box. Maybe not so much within the primary or the caucus, but nevertheless, for the general election, it does. And I think we do have a number of voters in Iowa and elsewhere that are really now starting to think a little more pragmatically about who can actually challenge, President Trump in the general election. And I would say that in Iowa, we do have a lot of very thoughtful voters, and they're probably thinking, you know, Elizabeth Warren has a lot of interesting ideas, and so does Bernie Sanders, but neither of those two individuals are electable, and maybe Mayor Pete or, of course, Joe Biden maybe really provide the opportunity to do that, to win the general. And so I think we're starting to see a little more, as I said, pragmatism set in within the Democratic electorate right now.
And obviously the elephant in the room here as far as Mayor Pete is concerned, Gary, is his sexuality. He's openly gay. He's got a partner. He's got a husband. He doesn't run away from it. But yet, Gary, as you well know, in fact, even as his campaign pointed out in a Daily Mail story about a month ago, they were doing focus groups, particularly, Gary, I found this interesting, with black voters and black male voters to see if there was a negative effect on his sexuality. And they are now, I guess there are concerns, especially with some of these southern primaries, how that might play out.
Yeah, you know, black voters in southern primaries, that's a whole different battle there. And many have said that, you know, the South Carolina primary, which follows the New Hampshire primary, you know, could possibly save Joe Biden's campaign, because I think after Iowa and New Hampshire, Biden is really going to be on the ropes. But given the large black participation in the South Carolina primary, and as you mentioned, the Super Tuesday primaries in the South, I think that really could save Biden. But you know, I think it's important to note that that one doesn't necessarily have to win the Iowa caucus, you know, or win
True.
The New Hampshire
yeah,
primary.
You're right.
But in Iowa, though, you do have to come in, history suggests, in the top three. In New Hampshire, you better place in the top two. But nevertheless, and you know, getting back to what you said about Buttigieg's sexuality, I think it's really not an issue at all within the Democratic Party among white voters. And I think that's something obviously to his benefit. But it is true when you get into minority voters and southern voters in particular, maybe southern whites, but not northern whites, that's where it really becomes, I think, somewhat of an issue, yeah.
You mentioned Gary, and the guest is Dr. Gary Rose from Sacred Heart University. You mentioned Elizabeth Warren, and today Lloyd Blankfein took a few good shots at her, and I'm guessing her and Leon Cooperman, one of the hedge fund guys, are not going to be sharing drinks at the same party. Cooperman says, listen, I'm as progressive as the next guy, but his famous letter to her, Gary, or a tweet a few weeks ago said, you are, shall we say, I won't use the word, he said, you are defecating on the American dream. And yeah. He was very angry. And even Lloyd Blankfein, I think, came out today on CNBC and said, I guess I'm a conservative dinosaur now. I always thought I was a Democrat. You think this is bothering her? Could this hurt her? Or, you know, are there Democrats looking up going, geez, this isn't good? What do you think?
Yeah, I do. You know, she has a strong base within the party. But it's a very left-wing, neo-socialist-based, even though she claims that she is a capitalist to her bones. But it seems like all of her policies certainly are very statist, which, of course, is, you know, somewhat neo-socialist, of course. And I think that, you know, when you do have Wall Street and you have these big contributors within the Democratic Party and a lot of pragmatic voters questioning Elizabeth's electability, I think that in the end, I think it's going to really, you know, bite her in when this contest really begins. And so, yeah, sure, that stuff is not helpful at all for Warren. You know, and I think some Democrats, older Democrats, certainly are remembering what happens when you nominate a far left candidate. And I'm sure they're thinking back to 1988, 1984,
yeah. Or even 72.
And then 72, oh. Right? That's exactly right, and that could once again spell disaster for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, amidst all the impeachment stuff going on, and who knows how much longer that's going to take, and what the outcome will be. There's another Democratic debate tonight, another one in the series trying to find out who will be the Democratic nominee coming up next year in 2020. Maybe to take on President Trump, maybe someone else if the president is forced to resign or is impeached. Gary Rose joins us, professor, chair of the political science department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Gary, Deval Patrick and Michael Bloomberg. Patrick is in, he says. Practically nobody showed up at his first event. Saw that the other day. Michael Bloomberg not in officially. He's done some paperwork. He can spend a boatload of money. I mean, people think Donald Trump has money. Michael Bloomberg is worth $50 billion. And he made an appearance the other day, Gary, in which he renounced stop and frisk when he was mayor of New York. That raised my eyebrows. That might be something you do if you're going to run.
I do think he's running this time. His strategy, Bloomberg, that is, his strategy is an interesting one. He said he's going to forego the Iowa caucus, New Hampshire primary, Nevada caucus, and South Carolina primary all in February, and then he's going to really compete on March 2nd in the Super Tuesday states. And I think it's pretty clear that he probably thinks that by the time February comes to a close, that there's going to be a real opening there on the moderate side of the party, because I think he feels that Biden is going to really be wounded in New Hampshire and Iowa. I don't think it's going to happen in South Carolina, but I'm not sure about Nevada. And so I think Bloomberg's strategy, which I don't believe is a very strategic move on his part, because we've seen candidates do this before, forego, you know, the so-called kingmakers, as they say in the literature on political science, and then think they can make a big splash in Super Tuesday. But if you don't have the momentum coming out of the, February, then there's a chance that you're not going to have much when March comes around. So I don't think it's a good strategy on his part.
And again, though, the guy, he did spend, Gary, I think $100 million or something really crazy in the last cycle just on ads targeting Congress. So the guy, I mean, he doesn't have to take 1 cent of a donation if he doesn't want to.
No, he doesn't. And he has, and as you mentioned, his donations to Democratic candidates, you know, has built up a pretty significant reservoir of IOUs and goodwill as well. And I think he feels that, you know, for Super Tuesday, with so many primaries and caucuses taking place on one day, that his money, you know, buying media time might be sufficient. But the fact of the matter is that primaries and caucuses still are retail, events. And for him to think that he can just get on TV in March and win this nomination, I think he's not thinking this thing through very well.
Yeah, the Deval Patrick thing, Gary, I found really interesting. And, you know, a friend of mine who lives in Massachusetts, who works in media, he kind of floated this thing. I said, well, what do you think? He said, well, he goes, he and Elizabeth Warren are kind of politically aligned. They believe in a lot of the, you know, same theories. But Deval Patrick is more palatable. He puts a more telegenic, more photogenic, almost like a Barack Obama kind of warmth about him. Do you think that might be what's going on here, Gary, or not?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. It is interesting. You're right. They are colleagues. They've known each other a long time, and they are friends. Yet at the and issue-wise, they're pretty close to one another too. But I think that he is a very liberal Democrat, but with a much nicer persona compared to Elizabeth Warren, which in politics, of course, so much of it is visceral and feelings about people. And, you know, I think I don't see Patrick, taking over Warren's position on the left. But nevertheless, I think he could, particularly because he is an African-American. And of course, right now, 25% of the Democratic Party is African-American, despite the fact that it's 12% in the country. And so I think he could be a serious player there and maybe even make a serious dent in the South Carolina primary, which could further derail Biden, too. So I think Deval Patrick is an interesting story. A lot of people aren't too familiar with him, but I think that that could change fairly quickly. And I do think he might be able to challenge Warren on the left somewhat.
Yeah. And Gary, looking ahead, and I know the Democrats have kind of altered their delegate rules because, you know, the Bernie people were very. But, you know, I'm wondering, Gary, now is the way the rules are written, I know that the superdelegates essentially can't bail anybody out until the second ballot, right? So the pledged delegates, they're only bound on the first ballot, correct?
That's right. That's right. And even then, they're not legally bound. They are, they are pretty much morally pledged to candidates. But after the first ballot, you're right, the pledged delegates are for all intents and purposes, free agents.
So
as well.
Michael Bloomberg or Deval Patrick or somebody, depending upon the way the polls break, Gary, and what's going on at the convention or the days leading up to it, we could see a scenario, am I correct, where if they want to and they say, listen, let's just go with Bloomberg, he's got the best shot here, Deval Patrick is a better face on some policies we like, they technically could do that, couldn't they?
Yeah, they could. And, you know, you've got this 15% rule within the Democratic contest, too, where, you know, if you get 15% of the vote in primaries or caucuses, you qualify for delegates. And we have so many of them running right now. I think some are going to be thinned out after tonight's debate. They may not make the December debates because the threshold has gone up. But nevertheless, you know, it is very possible that we could go into the Democratic convention without a clear front runner.
You know, Gary, you know what I love to see, and you teach this obviously in your classes all the time. I want to go back to some of those years and you and I read about, and where, you know, that nobody has enough delegates and they have to go to like 55 different ballots over 3 days.
God, would I love it.
Wouldn't that be great? I want to see people passed out on the floor, you know, people having and then the deal making for the vice president, like, you know, we got to get rid of Alvin Barkley. We got to have Truman. I mean, how great would that be for television ratings, Gary?
Yeah, you got to have some smoke-filled rooms there, too.
is the Pendergast machine still around for Harry Truman? Yeah.
I think a brokered convention would be such a delightful thing to see for a change, because these conventions now are nothing more than big campaign commercials.
So
let's bring back really some real decision making. Get the party leaders, the party chairs, to start negotiating tickets. And it would be fascinating. God, I would love it.
See, I'm not the only one that loves chaos. Gary, thank you. We appreciate the time as always, and we'll talk before the next big gathering. Thanks.
Okay, Paul.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Yep. See that? I'm not the only guy here who likes political chaos. See that? Even here's a guy who's a chair of the poli-sci department at Sacred Heart. And what did he say? Did you hear his eyes light up when I said multiple ballots? Abso-freaking-lutely. Right? Trump will be sitting there all, you know, the nominee. He will have survived impeachment and whatever. And I can see him going, I love it. Let them go to 40 different ballots. Oh, my God.